coughing and wheezing for air. He didn't know a grown man could cry like this. Wrung out at last, he curled up in the cab and stared through the windshield at the frigid light of the stars, at the gods who had come and gone and been forgotten. He watched the sky spin overhead, and all he could think was the word heartbroken. Heart broken.
Chapter 33. Why do you want to work for Birdsall and Son? In the office, Mercy and Lillian sat across from their third interviewee of the day, a miner searching for a safer line of work outside the borders of Tanria. Mercy had high hopes for this one, given the debacle of the first two interviews. But when he directed an unctuous smile at her, her hopes quickly dwindled.
Well, I have to say, ma'am, I like the view.
Thank you. We'll be in touch, Lil said.
I've only answered one question.
And we have all the information we need. You can let yourself out.
Damn women have no business in undertaking anyhow, he muttered as he left the office.
How did Pop find Danny in this morass? Mercy wondered aloud once they heard the front door close. Mercy had asked her sister to stay behind to help her with the interviews while Danny did deliveries, since they were going to be running the business together anyway. Plus, it seemed like a good way to force Pop to take a few days off. Now she felt like she was wasting Lillian's time. Maybe we should go to Temple and leave a truly impressive sacrifice for the Bride of Fortune. Dear Bride of Fortune, please send a woman to reply to our job opening for a new delivery driver, because men suck. Indeed they do. Mercy had been doing a decent job of not thinking about a mendacious Tanrian marshal every second of every day. But the mention of men's suckery made it difficult to sidestep her battered heart. She chucked her clipboard onto the desk and picked up the packet sent to her by the Quinter Lumber Corporation, which operated near the East Station. Why are you torturing yourself with that? We've done the math. The lumber rates are doable, but the shipment costs would sink us. They're the most reasonable offer we've had. That doesn't make it feasible. Even with the gains we're making on indigence, we can't afford it. We don't have the bargaining power of Cunningham's. They've got 6 locations. We're only us. Mercy perked up, an idea taking shape in her mind. But what if we did have bargaining power? What do you mean? Think about it. There are other undertakers operating around the West Station. Mayetta and Argentine both have undertakers. And I bet there's at least a couple up north that have been working with Afton. We're not the only ones affected by Cunningham's deal. If we form some kind of consortium with the others, maybe we can work out an arrangement with Quinter Lumber. Lil chewed the eraser of her pencil. It would depend on what kind of deal Quinter offered. I'd have to crunch the numbers, but yeah, it could work. Do you think they'll entertain the idea if it comes from a lady undertaker? I don't see the menfolk coughing up a better plan, and you've been the interim undertaker here for a year without raising too much of a stir. Maybe us border townies are a more progressive lot than you think. It can't hurt to send out feelers. The worst thing they could do is say no. Lil put the pencil out of its misery, setting it on the desk so that she could fold both hands over her pregnant belly. I wish I could figure out why Cunningham wants to shut us down so badly. It's literally keeping me up at night. Well, that and the fact that this one here gets the hiccups at 3 o'clock on the nose every night and dances on my bladder from dusk till dawn. Lil patted her stomach. But seriously, if you take our sales figures and inflate the numbers to match Cunningham's intake, plus the profit he's making off his ability to mark up the products he buys wholesale, plus the fact that he's cornered the market on embalming, I can't for the life of me see how our measly business cuts into his profits. Much as it pains me to say this, Zeddy was right. There's something shady going on here. Curtis Cunningham is Mr. Pillar of the community. Even if he were doing something shady, I can't imagine we'd be able to do anything about it. Mercy deflated, putting her elbow on the desk and resting her chin in her palm. If Cunningham is doing his level best to get rid of us, it stands to reason that he's trying to shut others down, too. We should find out which undertakers have shuttered over the past year to see if they have anything in common. That sounds nice and all, but I have an overflowing well downstairs and 4 boats to build this week. I don't have time to be Mercy Birdsall, Super Sleuth. You should put that on your business card. Mercy took off her glasses and rubbed at the headache blossoming in her forehead. Burying herself in work was what had prevented her from burying herself in heartbreak and misery these past few weeks. She was afraid to let her thoughts wander too far from the boatworks. They were likely to bump into topics better left untouched, such as how she missed the man who'd lied through his teeth to her. Lillian smacked her elbow. Come on, humor me. Which undertakers have closed their doors fairly recently? Mercy closed her eyes and envisioned a map of Bouchong and the border towns huddled around each of the four Tannery and Marshall's stations. She started north and worked her way clockwise, east, south, then west. Esta's mortuary and funeral rites, Dresser and Knops, Batena's funeral services. That's all I can think of off the top of my head. Lil jotted down the names and handed Mercy the list. What do they have in common? Mercy longed to deal with bodies and boats rather than Cunningham's hostile takeover, but she put on her glasses and dutifully read through the list. And a pattern emerged. Oh, she cried, her pulse dinging through her veins like a bell. She flew to the file cabinet, where she kept old financial records. Ladies and gentlemen, Mercy Birdsall, super sleuth, is on the case, Lil joked, as Mercy pulled out the file on the indigent processing grant and opened it on the desk. She riffled through the paperwork until she found the award letter that listed all the grant recipients. Batena's Funeral Services, Birdsall and Son, Cunningham's Funeral Services, Dresser and Knops, Esta's Mortuary and Funeral Rites. Mother of fucking sorrows, I knew it! Crowed Lillian over her shoulder. Mercy shook her head in disbelief. He wants a monopoly on the indigent processing grant? It's gotta be a pittance for him. He applied out of self-promotion, not for financial benefit. It isn't a pittance. Over the past 6 months, our indigent intake has gone up more than 200%, and I'm sure it's higher for him. It's like saving coppers in a piggy bank. A few here and there doesn't amount to much, but if you fill up the bank, it adds up. I'm telling you, he knew the intake was about to increase exponentially, which is why he shut everyone else down. Shady. How would he know that, though? It's not like he can get into Tanria to make the drudge problem worse. And who would make the drudge problem worse on purpose? A shady asshole who stands to make a huge profit? But how's he doing it? How do you make the undead? With dead people. What does he have an unlimited supply of? Dead people. Lillian slapped the desk to drive home her point. Yeah, but everybody coming out of Tanria has a punctured appendix, so it can't be reanimated. Not to mention the fact that someone would have to get all those cadavers past the checkpoint at the West Station. I'm telling you, Cunningham found a way. This guy hatched a nefarious plot to fill Tanria with dead bodies in order to swindle the government. That has got to be the least sexy evil plan ever. Mercy leaned against the tall file cabinet, feeling wrung out. I don't know, Lil. It seems pretty far-fetched to me. I think it's worth investigating. Maybe, said Mercy. But all of this talking and not working was making her feel again, and she was not in the mood to engage her emotions. In the meantime, I'm going to send letters to anyone who might be willing to team up with us on lumber purchases, and then I'm going to buy copious amounts of chocolate, and then I'm going to put in serious overtime to get through the workload today. Solid plan. Especially the chocolate part, but only if it also involves you buying me a blueberry muffin the size of my head. As Mercy slipped the letters to the undertakers into the Nim Killam box on Main Street, she had the familiar urge to write a letter to her pen pal. The same urge that had compelled her to write to him in the first place, the need for a friend. And then she remembered why she and Hart had broken up. She hated him for doing this to her, for ruining what they'd had together, and destroying the letters in one fell swoop. Hate's a strong word, Merciless. Do you really hate me? He asked in her memory. She wished she could hate him, but she didn't. The sad truth was that she loved him, even if she was struggling to forgive him. The same questions that cycled through her brain every night as she lay awake in her lonely bed somersaulted through her mind as she stood before the Nim Killam box on Main Street. Why had he written the letters in the first place? Why had the Nim Killam decided she was the recipient?
Why had he humiliated her at the Little Wren Cafe, only to turn around and woo her a week later? How could he have slept with her when he knew the truth? How could he have let things between them go as far and for as long as they had without telling her? She didn't bother to wonder if she would give him the chance to explain himself if he showed up on her doorstep. She knew that she would. The problem was that Hart had taken her at her word when she'd sent him packing. She had told him not to set foot in Birdsall and Son ever again, and he hadn't. Penn was the one who dropped off the bodies they secured, including Indigence. Hart could have taken them to Cunningham's. Instead, he was still making sure Mercy got the keyless bodies that he and Penn recovered in Tanria, and, therefore, the money that came with them. Such thoughtfulness was infuriating, given the circumstances. As Mercy walked up the street to Callahan's general store, she considered what it meant that, according to Lillian, indigent intake was up by over 200%. It followed that the drudge population inside Tanria had increased accordingly. If Lil's suspicions were correct, and Cunningham had found a way to smuggle dead bodies with intact appendices into Tanria, that put every marshal at greater risk. When she thought of the cuts and bruises she'd seen on Hart's skin during the months they dated, it made her blood boil. She might be livid with Hart, but the thought of him getting hurt or worse nagged at her without cease, particularly if Cunningham was increasing the drudge population on purpose. Truth be told, she was worried sick about him, and not simply because of the physical perils of Tanria. She had refused to ask Penn how he was doing the few times they'd crossed paths since the breakup, but the last time she saw him at the house, Penn had volunteered his opinion without her having to ask. "He's lost and miserable without you," Penn had informed her. "He's got a funny way of showing it," she had muttered in reply. She could reach out to Hart, but he was the one who had lied. He was the one who needed to explain himself. If he wasn't willing to swallow his pride and come after her, he didn't deserve her. And the fact that he apparently didn't feel compelled to beg her forgiveness was the reason why Mercy stalked the aisles of Callahan's general store to find a chocolate bar that would inadequately fill the emotional void inside her. She also picked up a blueberry muffin the size of her head for Lil. As she was paying at the register, she noticed a headline on the front page of the Eternity Gazette, smaller than the main headline, "Drudge on the Loose Kills Two in Harrington," and tucked into the corner, "Cunningham awarded patent for miracle embalming patch." And click, everything snapped into place. Pop had the Gazette delivered to the house every week, but Mercy forked over the change to buy a copy at the counter. She ran to Birdsall and Son as fast as her red canvas sneakers would carry her, threw open the door, and shouted, "Lil! I know how he's doing it!"
Chapter 34. The grief Hart felt as he plodded through his days beside Duckers cut differently than the knife of losing his mother or Bill or Gracie. They'd been taken from him. They had gone to a place where he couldn't follow. But Mercy was alive and well and living in the world without him. And the reason he couldn't be with her was because he'd messed it up irreparably. He'd done this to himself, and now he couldn't undo it, and it was tearing him up inside. He went through the motions, arresting smugglers and poachers, teaching Duckers how to pack sailcloth so that it didn't come spilling out of the pack, taking out drudges and watching their bitter souls float off into the winds of Tanria until they could infect someone else. At the end of each tour, Zeddy came to get Duckers at the station, while Hart returned to Tanria on his own to pick up overtime. It was always a relief to be alone with his sadness once Duckers was out of his hair, to drop the facade and simply be. But within a day or two, he ended up missing the kid more than he wanted to be by himself. Maybe that was why, camped out in Sector W-26 on a solo night shift, he took out a pen and the stationery that had long since sunk to the bottom of his pack and wrote one last letter to Mercy. Months ago, he had told a friend with no name and no face that he felt better for having applied the weight of his loneliness to a piece of paper. It held true now, although he slid the letter into his vest pocket rather than an Imkillum box. He thought he'd go back to the way he'd been before he fell in love with Mercy. But Mercy was the one who had made him see how years of worrying about his possible inability to die had resulted in a distinct failure to live, something he attempted to remedy now. When Duckers joked around with him, Hart found it in himself to crack the hard line of his mouth into a grin. When he sensed that he was spending too much time on his own, he went to Alma and Diane's for dinner or card games. He carried on pleasant conversations with a librarian who handled his interlibrary loans at the Harrington branch of the Bouchong Public Library. He did his best to live a little. The problem was that he wanted to live a little, or a lot actually, with Mercy, which wasn't going to happen. "Told you not to pick that one," Hart gloated, earning a glare from his apprentice. Things had come to a pretty pass when the world's most cheerful person, Penrose Duckers, could muster an honest-to-God scowl. But after a day of chasing after salt liquor, who kept running off in search of water, Duckers was worn to an exhausted nub, and his irritation was as electric as the scent of the imminent storm in the air. There was only one storm in Tanria, created by the old god of wrath, zigzagging through this prison as it bounced off the misty walls, and it was heading their way, which did nothing to improve Duckers' mood. Hart, on the other hand, was having no end of fun using salt liquor as an educational opportunity. He thanked the Bride of Fortune for bringing him such joy when he badly needed it. "I think we've learned a valuable lesson here, haven't we, Duckers?" Duckers growled. "In the future, you do what I tell you. Period. If I say pack two canteens, you..."
"Pack two canteens," Duckard answered flatly.
"If I say you need to run drills with your rapier, you..."
"Drop everything I'm doing and run drills with my rapier."
"And if I say don't pick that stallion because he's a pain in the ass, you..."
"Don't pick that stallion because he's a pain in the ass, sir."
Hart was debating whether or not he should fix Duckers' picket when Basarius arrived.
"Look at this sulking tit. What, does your pussy hurt, kid?"
Hart rubbed his forehead. "Thank you for once again personifying why the old gods needed to go." Basarius put his paw over his heart, and his face softened.
"Oh, that's sweet."
Hart poured the whiskey while Duckers dug his letters out of his pack. He couldn't resent the kid for his happiness, but watching the letters go back and forth between him and Zeddy remained a brutal reminder of what Hart had lost. He blew out a miserable breath before he noticed that Basarius was watching him.
"What?"
The rabbit nudged his arm.
"Been meaning to tell you. Sorry about your girl. That's rough."
Hart wasn't sure what was more surprising, Basarius's sympathy or the fact that Hart was touched by it. He nodded in gratitude. "Keep coming back for the kid. I'll tip." The Nimkillum had barely disappeared over the crest of a hill when salt liquor tore free of Duckers' inept knot and made a run for it.
"Have fun,"
Hart told his apprentice, making it clear he had no intention of helping. Duckers huffed and stalked off after his horrible mount, leaving Hart alone with his thoughts and his longing for the woman he'd lost. There was a boom nearby, followed by a burst of orange light sizzling in the sky. A flare, from the same direction Duckers had gone. An answering fear burst and hissed and sizzled inside Hart. All thoughts of Mercy abandoned, he strapped on his machete and grabbed an extra cartridge of pistol crossbow ammo before mounting his Equimaris and galloping after his apprentice. The flare dropped and blinked out as the mare tore through the trees, careening down a steep incline until her webbed feet splashed into the stream at the bottom of the ravine. With the water beneath her, she flew like an arrow, her nostrils flaring. Hart saw Duckers' lantern in the distance, and a flash of lightning illuminated his silhouette 10 yards ahead on the left bank of the stream, swinging his rapier like mad at not one but two shadowy forms. The stench of decay accosted Hart's nose above the clean scent of water and silt. With his heart thundering louder than the Equimaris's feet, Hart gripped the mare with his knees as he drew the machete in time to mow down one of the drudges trying to murder his apprentice. The mare shied and bucked in terror as the creature's head sailed past her flaring nostrils, and she tossed Hart ass first into the water. Thunder pounded through the sky, sending the Equimaris fleeing as the heavens opened. Rain poured over Hart in a punishing torrent. He jerked his head, trying to get his wet hair out of his eyes as he reached for the pistol crossbow holstered to his belt beneath the water's shifting surface. Another blinding shaft of lightning flashed across the churning clouds, and Hart found Duckers again as the apprentice ran his rapier through the drudge that still had its head, but missed the appendix. Hart's lantern had gone with his Equimaris, and now Duckers' light got swept into the rising water. Hart waited 5 agonizing seconds for his eyes to adjust to the darkness, then took aim at the dark shadow that was the drudge and fired, praying to the 3 fathers that he wouldn't hit Duckers by accident. The arrow sailed true, diving through the drudge's back, sinking into its appendix. It crumpled at Duckers' feet, sending its glowing amber soul flying into the night. Hart raced to the bank as fast as he could with the water sucking at his boots, but Duckers stabbed the headless yet animated drudge with a grunt, hitting his mark. By the time Hart reached him, the creature was down. Another bolt of lightning sent shards of blinding light into the darkness, illuminating Duckers' terrified face. "You all right?" Duckers nodded as the light disappeared, and a roll of thunder shuddered across the landscape. The next bolt lit the sky, illuminating not one, not two, but many drudges, lining up along the ridge. 10 drudges constituted a cluster, and there were more than 10 peering down at them, like falcons readying themselves to plunge at their prey. He and Duckers were nowhere near Sector 28. But that hardly mattered now. Every vein in Hart's body constricted with dread.
"Oh, fuck. Sir, move!"
Hart shoved Duckers ahead of him, holstering the pistol crossbow and unclipping the slingshot and flare from his belt. With the memory of Bill's death pressing upon him, he tried to light the flare as he ran behind his apprentice, but the wick was too wet to catch. He cast it into the water and pulled the pistol crossbow from his belt again. If anything happened to Duckers tonight, Hart wouldn't let himself finish that thought.
"You call this moving?" he shouted over the storm.
He pushed his apprentice from behind with his free hand, his right gripping his weapon. Duckers' rapier ticked like a metronome with the pumping of his arms as he ran. Movement from higher up the western incline caught Hart's attention as he and Duckers charged through the ravine. He turned to see 3 more drudges stumbling down the hill to cut them off from behind. When he whipped his head to face forward, several more formed a wall along the stream in front of them.
"What do we do, sir?"
Duckers' voice sounded like it belonged to a child. Hart stepped in front of him, barking orders, trying to sound calmer than he felt.
"Back to back. I've got the ones in front. You take the ones to our rear. Pistols first. Save the rapier for hand to hand. Fuck! It's all right."
It was not all right. The stream was rising at an alarming rate, lapping their calves as it ate away the narrow banks on either side. Trapped in the bottleneck of the ravine, Hart knew that he and Duckers were fish in a barrel. It was Bill all over again, except this time, Hart was supposed to be the adult in charge, when he felt more like a scared kid. But then Duckers' warmth at his back reminded him of what he owed his apprentice.
"You're a good shot, Marshal. Don't panic. Take aim and fire. That's all you have to do."
"Yes, sir."
Duckers' voice was a wet whimper as lightning cut a jagged scar across the sky. The accompanying thunder was the bell that signaled the beginning. The drudges leaped forward from both directions, and the fight began. Hart got off 5 shots, but with no light to see by except the searing whiteness of lightning. He took down only 2 before the remaining 4 drudges were nearly on him. Instead of firing 1 last shot, he took those precious seconds to holster the pistol crossbow and draw both the rapier and the machete. the weapon of precision in his dominant right hand, the hacking blade in his left. The next moments were a blur of jabbing, cutting, slicing, and chopping. Hart kept Duckers at his back at all times, even when he ought to dodge or faint. He might be immortal, but his apprentice definitely wasn't. So Hart did whatever he could to make sure that every scratch and grab and bite landed on his own skin, not Duckers's. A drudge got close enough to his left side to bite his arm. A burst of agony bloomed where teeth met flesh, tearing a hole in his shirt and sending blood oozing down his skin. He shoved hard, dumping the drudge into the rising water. It sputtered up, shrieking with an outrage that was cut short when Hart swung the machete and sliced into the creature's side, cleaving its rotting body all the way to the appendix. He ripped the blade out and sliced through the air in the opposite direction, hacking off the head of another drudge and skewering the body through the appendix with his rapier in the same breath. All the while, the stream rose and swelled, tugging against Hart's knees, then his thighs, filling up the narrow ravine like a tap on full blast. He stumbled against the current as he lunged for another drudge, missing the target and leaving his right side vulnerable. The drudge scraped three gashes across the skin of his neck with jagged fingernails as it tried to grasp his throat. Lightning blasted into a tree high up the ridge with an explosion of sound. The trunk splintered, sending the elm crashing down the ravine, straight toward them. Hart gored his drudge with his rapier and sent its soul into the stormy night. And then he grabbed Duckers by the back of his waterlogged jacket to pull him away from the oncoming tree. A drudge hopped on his back, biting into the crook where his neck met his shoulder, sending a shaft of pain through Hart's body. He let go of Duckers and tried to twist out of its grip. The next thing he knew, Duckers was forcibly turning him, then ramming his rapier into the drudge so hard, he ran the blade through the drudge's body and poked a hole into Hart's back. Hart cried out in pain, and Duckers shouted, "Sorry, sir!" a second before the tumbling tree hit the water and knocked the kid into the current, sweeping him up in its branches and carrying him deeper into the heart of danger.
"No!"
screamed Hart so loud he felt as if he were tearing apart the inside of his throat and his heart right along with it. The current slammed against his hips as the remaining drudges sprang at him, and there was no time to mourn or think. The world became a tiny, focused pinprick of survival. The rain poured down, and lightning spasmed into the darkness, and thunder shook the earth as Hart jabbed and sliced and dodged and lived and lived and went on living as he dispatched lost souls into the Tamrian night. The water rose, and the rain washed his blood into the stream. He swung and missed, thrust and hit, and still the drudges came for him. If he was capable of dying, this was the way he was going to go. And if Duckers was dead and gone on his watch, he wasn't sure he could live with himself anyway. Something in the water's current shifted, a force drawing Hart backward. He turned his head in time to see Salt Licker, gleaming in a flash of lightning, cutting against the current as the stallion headed straight for him. He dodged, trying to swim for the side of the ravine as one of the drudges caught the hem of his dungarees. With the last of his sapped strength, he kicked free and reached his long arms toward a sapling, pulling himself to shore in time for the Equimaris to trample the drudges, sending half of them careening downstream. The stallion grasped another in its huge teeth and flung it into the water as if it were nothing but a stuffed toy. A bolt of lightning lit Duckers' face atop the Equimaris, which made the inside of Hart's chest expand achingly with relief. From Salt Licker's back, the apprentice cut and skewered the remaining drudges until there was nothing left to fight. For now, at least.
"Think you can hop on, sir?"
Duckers called down to him as Salt Licker trod the roiling water. Hart's wounds sucked away at his strength, but the alternative was drowning, so he didn't have much choice.
"Give me a hand,"
he yelled over the deafening stream. Between the two of them, they managed to get him onto Salt Licker's back. By the time he got himself straddled across the stallion behind Duckers, all he could do was slump against his apprentice and try not to faint as they rode out of the ravine.
"I don't know whether to kiss you or shoot you,"
Hart slurred once they left the rain and the stream behind them, the water sloshing inside his ruined boots with the rhythmic canter of the Equimaris.
"Are you talking to me or Salt Licker?"
"Salt Licker, I wouldn't kiss you in a million years."
Once they got to their campsite, Hart was barely clinging on. Duckers dismounted and tried to coax him off the Equimaris.
"We need to treat those wounds, sir."
The bite on the side of his neck was about 3 inches wide, but it felt as if it were taking up the entire left half of his body. And the one on his arm hurt so badly, he thought he might be sick, but he shook his head.
"If I manage to get off this dickhead, I'm not going to be able to get back on."
"Are you hurt real bad?"
Duckers asked as he unzipped his sleep sack and threw it around his mentor's shoulders.
"Not great. You?"
"Not great, but better than you."
Hart nodded.
"We both need to get to the infirmary. Skip the barracks. Think you can make it back to the station?"
"Yeah. Can you?"
"Yep."
Hart suspected that was a lie, but he managed to stay on the back of the Equimaris, shivering so hard, his teeth rattled as Duckers rode through the night, all the way to the station and the infirmary.
Chapter 35. When Mercy arrived at Pop's house to strategize next steps for Operation Takedown, Lil's moniker, she expected to be greeted with a glass of wine and a platter of Zeddy's tapas. She did not expect to find Penrose Duckers lying on the sofa in the parlor, his head propped up on a million pillows, his arm in a sling, and one of his eyes bruised and swollen shut, while her father snored in the recliner next to him.
"Pen! My gods! Are you all right?" cried Mercy, as she knelt on the floor beside him.
"Yeah, but you should see the other guy."
She knew it was meant as a joke, but as far as Mercy was concerned, the other guy meant Hart.
"What happened?"
"Got attacked by a million drudges."
Mercy gasped as Lil came into the parlor with a cup of tea for Pen.
"Here you go, sweetie,"
she cooed as she handed him the cup.
"Is that Mercy?" Zeddy called from the kitchen. "Tell her to let the invalid rest."
Pen smiled as much as his bruised lips would let him.
"He's making me chicken noodle soup. Don't tell him, but Hart makes a much better version of this."
He held up his teacup, and Mercy recalled with a bittersweet pang the way Hart's fingertips had brushed her skin as he placed a similar concoction into her hands. She worried that he was hurt as badly as Pen, but that there was no one around to do the same for him. As if he could read her mind, Pen said,
"You gonna ask about him?"
There was no point in pretending.
"Is he okay?"
"He will be. Probably. But he took a worse beating than I did, mostly because he made sure that the drudges got to him and not to me. He's staying at the chief's house until he heals up."
A sob of relief rose from her lungs, and she slapped her hand over her mouth to stop any more from coming up.
"He's fine," she told herself,
remembering how quickly his pistol crossbow wound had healed. But the speed of his healing was and wasn't a comforting thought. Pen gestured at her with his uninjured hand.
"Look at you. You're miserable. And he's miserable. You're both miserable. Why don't you talk to each other?"
"Dang. It's not that simple."
Mercy toyed with the fraying seam of the blanket over Pen's legs.
"I do care about him. But he's a mess. And I can't fix him. And I shouldn't have to."
Pen mulled this over, nodding slowly. "For what it's worth, he's a lot less messy than he used to be. He's trying. Maybe you should hear him out." Emotionally exhausted, Mercy let herself fall face first into an empty section of the sofa cushions next to Pen's legs. Her glasses pushed painfully into the right side of her nose, but she couldn't bring herself to care.
"I'm not supposed to know about the whole secret pen pal thing, but I do. So let me say this. I think he didn't tell you about the letters because he was scared he'd lose you if you found out."
"He lost me because he didn't tell me."
Mercy still had her face buried in the cushion, but Lil, who was hovering over the sofa, didn't miss a beat.
What letters? Wait, the letters? Hart Ralston was your anonymous friend?
Thanks, Pen. Mercy groused into the cushion. Either Pen didn't hear her sarcastic tone, or he chose to ignore it. He pulled the curtain of her hair away from her face with his good hand. Give him a chance. There was a time when Mercy would have told him that she never wanted to see Hart's lying face again, but all it took to cure her of that notion was the thought that he, A, was badly hurt, and B, had almost died. She settled for whimpering into the sofa upholstery, which smelled an awful lot like Leonard. Zeddy came into the parlor and clicked his tongue when he saw Mercy encroaching on his boyfriend's sofa territory. He nudged her off the furniture with a ladle. Go away! You're tiring the invalid! Mercy sat up and regarded Penn's bruised face. She could only guess how badly Hart was injured, and it lit a fire inside her. If her suspicions were right, if Curtis Cunningham was filling up Tanria with the drudges so that he could make more money, if Penn and Hart and all the other marshals were in greater danger because of Cunningham, Mercy was done letting him get away with it. We've got work to do, Lil, she said through the grim set of her teeth. Ooh, are we plotting how to take down the man now? Mercy punched her fist in the air. We are taking down the man! Pop snorted awake in his recliner. Oh, hey, Muffin. I didn't hear you come in. I thought you said you were bringing donuts this time, Mercy complained as she watched the dock gate of Cunningham's funeral services through Pop's old travel binoculars. No, I said I was bringing my donut for my hemorrhoids. Lil pointed at the pillow under her butt before turning to the sheriff's deputy sitting to her right. Don't ever get pregnant, McDouchebag. It's the full body experience from old hell. Thanks. I'll keep that in mind. Maybe don't call me a douchebag when I've agreed to help you out, though, Nathan McDevitt replied from the far end of the duck bench. Mercy, who sat in the driver's seat, leaned over her sister's bulbous stomach. Thank you for being here, Nathan. We appreciate it. Why did we bring him? Lillian whispered to Mercy, as if Nathan couldn't hear her when he was literally crammed up against her in the auto duck. In case Cunningham's henchmen want to murder us when we catch them red-handed? Yeah, all right. That makes sense. Mercy and Lillian had cased Cunningham's for several days before they witnessed him loading cadavers into an unmarked auto duck in the alley late last All God's Day night. It made sense. Taking care of their criminal dealings on the one day a week when undertakers didn't work. No one would be around to witness their questionable deeds. Now, it was the following All God's Day night. And this time, they had brought law enforcement with them, also known as Mercy's ex-boyfriend. Leonard grunted on Nathan's lap. He didn't smush his jowls against the deputy the way he had slobbered over Hart. Does your dog have to sit on me? Well, he can't sit on me, said Lillian, pointing at her belly. There's no room, and Mercy's in the driver's seat. Nathan sulked against the passenger side door. I can't believe I let you two talk me into this. You know this guy donates to orphanages and stuff like that, right? And he dumps cadavers with patched-up appendices into Tanria, said Lillian. I still don't get how that would work or why anyone would want to smuggle dead bodies into Tanria. It makes no sense. Mercy had already gone over this with him twice. She stifled a sigh of impatience before she explained it once again. Cunningham has developed special embalming patches to put over a body's wounds and blemishes. They make the remains look more natural for the grieving who want to have an open boat funeral service. But they bond to human tissue and blend in so well that Cunningham can actually repair a gouged appendix and toss the body back into Tanria to get reanimated all over again. When the body comes back to him via the Tanrian marshals, he cashes in on the indigent processing grant. It's like patching a tire, McDouchebag, except the mechanic is the one leaving nails on the street and then profiting off the repair. Lil added. Which is why he wants to shut us down along with all the other grant recipients, Mercy finished, before Nathan could object to Lillian's McDouchebag comment. I checked his records, Mercy. Everybody is accounted for, including the indigents he processes and dumps in the burial pits.
But what if he's sending home empty boats to the families of the people who bought funeral packages from him? Most folks request closed boat services, and it's not like anyone is going to bust open the planks to make sure there's a body inside. Who knows what's in the urns he's sending home?
I'm humoring you for one night. If Curtis Cunningham turns out to be the heinous villain you say he is, I'm going to turn in my badge and take up professional macrame.
Is that a promise? Lil muttered. Are you sure you should be here? Mercy asked her sister for the fifth time that evening. Danny and Pop will both have my head when they find out I took you on a risky surveillance mission of a possible crime lord.
Pish, I'm a grown woman. I do what I want.
Mercy heard the faint sound of the gate going up, and she trained her binoculars on Cunningham's dock.
There, look.
She saw Cunningham himself, clearly visible in the gaslight, before she handed the binoculars to Nathan. The team members of Operation Takedown sat in silence and watched as Cunningham and one of his men loaded six bodies into the hold of an unmarked duck.
See? Lillian hissed at Nathan.
A funeral director is loading dead bodies into the hold of a duck. How shocking.
At 11 o'clock at night on All God's Day?
Fair point.
Both men got into the duck's cab, pulled away from the dock, and headed down the alley in the opposite direction. Lil touched Mercy's arm.
Are we following them this time?
I'm on it, said Mercy. She started up the engine and followed Cunningham down Main Street, hoping he wouldn't notice the birdsall auto duck in his rearview mirror. Nathan gripped the window crank.
It's illegal to drive without your lights on, you know.
Shut up, Mercy and Lil told him in unison. Have you never tailed someone before?
Lil asked him.
No, have you?
Lillian pursed her lips.
No comment.
The silence inside the Birdsaw family auto duck grew thick with tension as they followed Cunningham at a distance.
This is weird, Mercy said 20 minutes after they passed the exit for the West Station.
When the duck in front of them pulled off the road and drove cross-country toward the mist, she added,
And it just got weirder.
She turned the wheel, and now Mercy and her pregnant sister and her ex-boyfriend and her dog were jouncing in the cab as the duck rolled along the uneven ground.
I hope this doesn't induce labor, Lillian said,
and Nathan went green around the gills.
Oh my gods, I am not delivering a baby tonight.
No one asked you. Of course I'm going to make Mercy do it.
Mercy was too busy navigating Bouchong's desert terrain to comment on her potential midwifery. She spotted two more vehicles in the distance, parked close to the mist. Cunningham's duck pulled up beside them and parked. They all had their headlights on, so Mercy brought her duck to a halt, close enough to keep an eye on things, but far enough away to stay out of the beams of light. Team Operation Takedown stayed in the cab and watched as the men unloaded body after body from the holds. Lil took her turn with the binoculars.
They're putting a circular object onto the mist. Do you know what one of those illegal portals looks like, Nathan?
It must be serious if you're calling me by my name instead of McDouchebag.
He took the binoculars from her and peered through the lenses.
Oh, wow. Okay, you two might be onto something.
I see a bright future in professional macrame for you.
Ha ha, stay here. I'm going in.
What? Nathan, no, said Mercy. There are six of them and one of you. Let's go back and report this to Sheriff Connolly.
By the time we get to Eternity and notify the sheriff, these goons will be long gone.
But we're eyewitnesses. Surely that's enough to arrest Cunningham first thing tomorrow morning.
Offended, Nathan placed a hand over his heart.
Mercy, I'm a professional. I've got this.
I feel like he doesn't have this, Lil said,
as she and Mercy watched Nathan approach the men stuffing cadavers through a pirated portal into Tanria.
Maybe we should leave him here and get the sheriff? We can't leave him. We're the reason he's here in the first place.
By now, Nathan had stepped into the beams of the headlights, waving his badge in the air. And while Mercy couldn't clearly hear what was being said, she could tell things were going downhill quickly. He dropped his badge and reached for his sidearm. There was shouting, followed by one of Cunningham's men drawing a pistol crossbow and firing at Nathan. He dove out of the way, losing his revolver as he hit the ground, and the arrow shot a hole through Mercy's windshield. Nathan rolled to his feet and tackled the shooter. Another man joined in the fray as Cunningham stumbled to the side.
Stay here,
Mercy told Lillian as she got out of the cab.
That's what he said. Are you seriously making a that's what he said joke right now? No, that's what Nathan literally said. And now they're shooting at us.
Leonard squeezed past Lil and followed Mercy out of the duck.
He's a weasel, but I can't throw him to the wolves.
With that, Mercy ran toward the melee. Leonard sprinted ahead of her, snarling and growling. Mercy's dog, who couldn't be bothered to lift his head most days, was now chasing two terrified employees of Cunningham's funeral services across the desert. Cunningham climbed into his duck as Nathan traded blows with the three remaining thugs. On the other side of the portal, one of the cadavers shifted and rolled and got to its reanimated feet. Mercy watched in horror as it shambled through the portal and into the Bushong night. Everyone froze as the dead body of an elderly woman walked through the fray. One of the men fighting Nathan screamed and ran away into the night, while another staggered away in shock, tripped over his own boots, and hit his head on a rock, knocking himself unconscious. Nathan, who had a bloodied fist raised, ready to pummel the last of Cunningham's henchmen, gaped at the drudge, while the man in his grasp said, "Mom? You're putting my mother's remains in Tanria, Cunningham?" The livid employee lunged out of Nathan's grasp and pulled Cunningham out of the auto duck. Mercy could see more cadavers reanimating on the other side of the mist, so she raced to the portal and attempted to pull it loose. It wouldn't budge. She frantically pushed buttons and pulled levers as a bloodless arm reached for her from the Tanrian side of the border. She pounded her fist on the frame, and the portal slammed shut, cutting the arm off with it. Clawing her fingers around the edge, she finally yanked it out of the mist and threw it to the ground. The blast of a revolver shattered the air, and the man who had attacked Cunningham collapsed at the Undertaker's feet. Another shot, and the drudge went down too. Disheveled and breathing hard, Cunningham leveled his revolver at Mercy. Fear flooded her bloodstream. The whole world narrowed to the barrel aimed at her face. "Take one more step toward me, deputy, and your girlfriend will get a bullet through the head." Mercy sensed Nathan going still behind her. She wanted to tell Cunningham that Nathan was not her boyfriend, and that her boyfriend was a Tanrian marshal named Hart Ralston, and she did not want to die without seeing him again. "Oh, Mercy, sweetheart. It didn't have to be like this," Cunningham said with appalling sincerity. "You could have made a tidy sum from my purchase of Birdsall and Son and sailed for better waters. Now I'll have to." Oof! An unidentified object flew through the air and beamed Cunningham in the head. Nathan took the opportunity to launch himself at the seedy Undertaker, disarming him, slamming him to the ground, and cuffing his hands behind his back. Mercy's legs wouldn't hold her up, and she plopped onto the sandy earth as Nathan said, "Curtis Cunningham, you are under arrest." Lil waddled into the light of the headlamps as quickly as her cankles would allow. "Mercy, are you all right?" "I think so. We took down the man," Mercy answered in stunned disbelief. Lillian patted the top of her sister's head, since she couldn't bend over to hug her. "Yes, we did. We took down that human hemorrhoid with a donut pillow." Mercy looked over at the item that Lil had thrown at Curtis Cunningham's head and burst into a hysterical fit of giggles. Leonard trotted into the light and dropped a pair of torn plaid boxer shorts into her lap, his nubbin tail twirling.
Chapter 36. With an afghan wrapped around his shoulders, Hart stepped out the screen door of Alma and Diane's house to let the west wind of Bushong tousle his hair, which was in need of a trim again. He watched the sun set over the pasture and thought of all the times he'd brought Gracie here, and for once, it gave him pleasure to remember his dog. The grief hadn't gone anywhere, but he could recall the happiness in equal measure now. "Maybe I should get another dog," he thought with sincerity for the first time, as Alma stepped outside and stood next to him. They stayed like that as the sun sank lower over the horizon, obscuring their faces, covering them in dusk. "How are you holding up?" she asked him. Hart considered keeping his thoughts to himself, but what was the point of patching things up with Alma if he was going to go on bottling himself up all the time? "I'm a wreck, but I'm hanging in there."
"Are you a wreck because Mercy dumped you?"
"That's one reason. I fucked up a good thing."
"Have you tried apologizing?"
"It was one of those fucked up too much for apologies kind of fuck-ups."
"For what it's worth, I think whatever happened between you and Mercy did you more good than harm."
Hart nodded. It was easier to talk to his friend in the twilight world, where everything was dim and hard to see. It made him braver. He spoke again. The librarian in Harrington helped me track down Bill's wife and daughter last month. His wife sailed the Salt Sea 11 years ago, but the daughter is living in southern Honeck. She's a dentist, married, has a couple of kids. It sounds like she's doing well. She was kind when she wrote to me, but it's clear that she doesn't want to continue the correspondence. She doesn't want that connection to Bill in her life. I get that. To his surprise, Alma slipped her arm around his waist and squeezed him gently. Not that there was a need to be gentle. His wounds were almost completely healed. Her affection made his eyes blur and his throat burn. You're a good man, Hart. And a messy demigod. He took a shaky breath. The night sky made him feel small, swallowing his voice when he spoke again. How do you do it?
How do I do what?
Live like a normal person when you're not sure if you're ever going to die.
What else are you going to do?
It's not that easy.
Sure it is.
She took her arm from his waist and stood before him. The gaslight coming from the kitchen windows illuminated her face, and her aquamarine eyes gleamed in the twilight.
The odds aren't there. I mean, how many demigods do you know?
I can think of 10 or 11, all marshals.
And how many of those demigods do you know for certain are immortal?
One.
Rosie Fox?
Hart nodded.
Same. The new gods aren't like the old gods. They're a generation removed from the unknown. And to be honest, I don't think they're so different from us. The halfies of the old gods were far more likely to be immortal, and most of them found their way up there.
Alma nodded toward the stars. Unbidden, one of Mercy's letters came to Hart's mind. He could see the way the words slanted and looped across the page.
I suppose it puts things into perspective. Or it's more accurate to say that you put things in perspective for me. To gaze up at the night sky and feel a part of something bigger than myself. I can see why you're worried, and to be honest, I'm worried for you, Alma continued. I'd like to think that healing quickly is simply your gift, but if all you can do is take things one day at a time, like anyone else.
Hart was tempted to tell her about his gifts and about what had happened to Bill, but he decided to save that for another time. Instead, he astonished both of them by dragging Alma into a hug. She sniffed hard against his chest.
Sap, she called him,
but she hugged him tighter. He lay awake on the guest bed as the prospect of his immortality loomed over him, feeling more like a fact than a possibility. The bedspring squeaked in protest as he turned onto his side, trying to get comfortable. The guest bed was better than his camping cot, but it paled in comparison to Mercy's giant soft mattress. Then again, any bed without Mercy in it felt empty. He wondered if that emptiness would dissipate with time. Part of him hoped it would, and part of him hoped it wouldn't. He thought of Mercy standing on the curb in her yellow skirt as a drudge reached out for her with a decayed arm. He thought of Duckers at his back, fighting off a cluster of drudges well outside the bounds of Sector 28. He thought of Bill, bloodied and in pain, begging him to punch a hole in his appendix so that he wouldn't be reanimated. He thought of the smiling wives and doting husbands, and all the families whose lives have been torn apart by the drudge problem inside Tanria, a problem that was slowly seeping outside the mist as well, a problem that got worse every single day. And here he was, lying in bed, when he was the one person in the world who might be able to solve the issue once and for all. He knew what needed to be done, and the more he thought about it, the more he knew he'd do it. If he succeeded, Duckers and everyone else inside Tanria would be safer, and Mercy and everyone else in the border towns would be safer too. If he failed, at least he'd find out if he was mortal or immortal. For 36 years, not knowing his fate had been slowly killing him. Tonight, at last, Hart intended to live. He emptied out his pack because everything he needed was at the station. He considered taking his grandfather's watch with him, but decided to leave it behind. He wound it and set it on the bedside table, and hoped it would still be ticking when and if he returned. At dawn, he got up and tiptoed down the hall to press his palm against Alma and Diane's bedroom door, as if he could pass all the warmth and gratitude he felt for them through the wood grain. "Thank you," he whispered. Then he sneaked out of the house, letting the front door snick shut behind him. Hart stopped in Mayetta to treat himself to breakfast at the Little Wren Cafe. Sitting at the table where he and Mercy had quarreled, he spent a couple of hours finishing the copy of Enemies and Lovers that he had checked out from the library during his last visit to Harrington. He figured that if he could no longer love Mercy in person, he could at least love her through the pages of her favorite novel. He lost himself as he read, seeing his own loneliness and regret in the character of Samuel Dunn. And like Samuel, he fell a little in love with irreverent Eliza Cannondale. When he finished, he noticed that his waiter was glaring at him for staying so long. He paid his tab, left an enormous tip, and listened to the jingling of the door chimes with fondness as he left. He hopped into his duck and drove to Harrington. The air was uncommonly cool as he stood outside the public library, waiting for it to open at 10 o'clock.
"Good morning, Marshall Ralston,"
Mabel Scott, Hart's favorite librarian, greeted him at the door as she unlocked it.
"What can I help you find this morning?"
"Nothing today. I'm returning books, but I'm not taking any out." She pointed to a metal slot in the building's brickwork.
"You know, there's a book drop outside. You needn't have waited for me to open up."
"I know, but I wanted to thank you for keeping me in books all these years," he told her as he handed her the stack he was returning.
"It's my pleasure. Oh, Enemies and Lovers, I love this book."
"So do I," he said. And then he walked to his duck and drove himself to the North Station. Not that anyone would question him at his home base, but it made more sense to enter Tanria through a point where no one knew he wasn't on duty. He skipped the commissary altogether and headed straight for the weapons lockers, where he checked out an extra machete with an accompanying sheath and backstrap, 2 extra pistol crossbows, 2 boxes of crossbow ammo, and an arm dagger. Normally, Hart found arm daggers too showy for his taste. Today, it seemed practical. He passed by the flares for the same reason he passed by the commissary. There wasn't a point.
"Grandfather Bones, are you taking out an army or what?"
commented the woman checking out his weapons, a lit cigarette fuming between her yellow teeth. Hart said nothing in reply as he signed out. He packed up his supplies and headed for the stables. It had been less than 2 weeks since he and Duckers had faced the Drudge Cluster, but somehow, Salt Licker had wound up at the North Station, as if the Bride of Fortune had placed him there herself. "Figures," Hart muttered. But then he remembered the way this beast had stuck around and rescued Duckers from the rising waters, the way he hadn't shied away from the Drudges that night. He stroked the Equimaris's soft nose, incongruously delicate beneath his calloused hand.
"You know what? You're exactly the asshole for the job."
He saddled up and rode into Tanria with a pack more full of weapons than food, because he wasn't planning to stay long. Halfway to his destination, he stopped to let Salt Licker rest and graze and curl his feet in a stream while Hart brewed a pot of tea and ate an apple. It wasn't much of a last meal, but he made a point of savoring the tea. As he drank, he sat quietly, his back against a tree trunk. One by one, he thought about the people who had mattered to him, pushing aside the remorse and regret that usually accompanied his memories. He wanted only love at his side now. Mom, Grandpa, Aunt Patty, a tiny bit, Bill, Gracie, Alma, Diane, Duckers, Mercy. He wished he could read Mercy's letters one last time, but he'd left them in her apartment that God's forsaken night she had sent him away. When his cup was empty, and there didn't seem to be any reason to linger, he tugged the Equimaris from the stream. Salt Licker threw his head, protesting Hart's pulling him to dry land.
"You might be the last living creature I see on this earth, so quit being a dick," Hart told him.
The Equimaris didn't care, but all of a sudden, Hart did. He'd tamped down his fear up till this point, but now that he was facing the last leg of the journey, it was creeping up his spine and spilling into his lungs. He closed his eyes and remembered Mercy's fingers in his hair, her thumbs wiping the tears from his cheeks. "Don't you ever go back there. Don't you ever try to open that door again." Would she be angry with him if she knew what he was about to do? Or had she stopped caring about him the day she found out he'd lied to her? He couldn't stand the idea of causing her any more pain than he had already. But he'd be a liar if he said that he didn't want her to grieve his passing. Selfish bastard that he was, he still wanted to matter to her. And because he could not cling to Mercy, he threw his arms around the stallion's neck, pressing his face against the slimy mane. He hugged Salt Licker until he was ready to let go, and he climbed into the saddle, his resolve steady and true. He arrived at Sector 28 at sunset, staring at the house in the field from the same vantage point he'd had all those years ago as he stood beside Bill. Given the failure of that mission, he probably should have started from a different point. But if Hart was going to finish what they'd begun, he'd go full circle. This was where he'd start. "If it gets too rough,